If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands, dust off your broomsticks, and join us as we unlock the treasures behind Chamber of Secrets, Chapter 8, The Death Day Party.
Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man. Okay, so let me just say right out of the gate, right up there with the heist to steal the locket, in book 7 from the Ministry. Mm-hmm. This has got to be one of my lesser favorite events of the entirety of the saga.
The Death Day Party.
Yeah. I will say that, like, we ended chapter 7 and I saw the chapter art and I saw the chapter 8 and I saw the title and I was like, ah, oh, man. I'm so enamored with everything to do with the series. It's all so much fun, and I always enjoy getting lost in the magic. And then this one popped up, and I was like, next week's episode's gonna be. I'm gonna have to really dig deep for this one. And then I will say that I read the chapter, and I was like, this is actually. I mean, it is fun.
It is fun. A lot of very interesting things happen. A lot of interesting things get set up. There's like a weird amount of drops for like book 6 stuff that happens in this particular chapter. You do get like a much more up close look at all of the ghosts. The Chamber of Secrets is like officially opened, so that's exciting.
That's true.
So there are some things that happen, but it's like this is one of the things they didn't put it in the movie. They just sort of like, instead of going to the Death Day party, Harry just discovers what the cat on the same day as he does the detention. Is that right?
I don't know. Yeah, I was trying to remember exactly how this goes. And on that exact note, let's just talk about the cat itself because it is also part of the chapter art.
Oh, what's the chapter art? All right.
And I say the cat as if we don't know the cat to be Mrs. Norris. Mm-hmm. So the chapter art itself depicts Mrs. Norris looking... I mean, and I mean this in the most loving way per the internet and memes possible, but rather cat derpish.
Yeah, it's pretty derpy.
I think there's even like maybe, I think it's a little bit of like a tongue sticking out.
Yes, and
like
definitely.
Some frayed whiskers coming off of poor Mrs. Norris there. It actually gives much more of like a potentially empathetic feeling towards a cat that otherwise is generally regarded as being like the worst.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is the worst, but it's like you probably still don't want her dead.
No, of course not. Right, yeah, never. But I was just saying, I feel like maybe like a tick more endearing per the chapter art than I usually feel towards the character itself. The one thing that I'm most curious about is what Mrs. Norris was doing with her tail wrapped around this torch.
Do you know, that is an interesting note because I was going to say, well, clearly Ginny just hangs her on the torch post-petrification.
That's dark.
It is dark, but also maybe impossible, right? Because if you're petrified, the tail wouldn't bend?
It wouldn't bend, yeah, for sure. So you would almost need like the tail to already be like pre-curled.
Pre-curled. So
it's like, I don't really know, because the other thing too, at least in the chapter art, depicts like a flaming torch.
Yeah.
So like, you could imagine a world where maybe Mrs. Norris would be like posted up, like parked on top of like a lantern or something, like mounted on the side of the wall, and then like just sort of like swung down and was sort of like dangling. But I do feel like the compromised position that we find Mrs. Norris in doesn't work quite as well as it does for the rest of the characters in the the ways in which we find them per their petrification.
Yeah.
If that tracks.
I guess there's water on the ground, so maybe she jumped up on the torch to avoid the water, because she's supposed to have seen it in the reflection.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's possible. It still doesn't seem like she would wrap her tail around it.
Not necessarily. I mean, it doesn't feel completely broken to me. Like, I know that cats do sort of like, you know, they're always having an activity with their tail.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was just like one of those things that I feel like I was looking at the chapter art and I was thinking about it as I dove into this chapter. And I was like, it is kind of odd that this is how, because that's the thing. This is the first attack we have. And the fact that Mrs. Norris is hanging from the lamppost is pretty like grim.
It is pretty grim because I feel like we're just splitting hairs. It feels like what's most likely happened is that Jenny put her up there.
Okay.
Is what I think. I don't think that should be possible based on what you know, petrification
supposedly does. Yeah.
But even when I saw the chapter art, I was like, is this right? Why is she hanging from a torch? I always like imagine her hanging from the ceiling, and then you could tie the rope to the end of her tail despite the shape. I think that's how it is in the movie too. She's just like hanging from the ceiling.
Is that right? Am I remembering this so completely wrong?
I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. I haven't watched Chamber of Secrets in a while. But in this chapter, it does actually say Mrs. Norris, the caretaker's cat, was hanging by her tail from the torch bracket. So
okay, there we go.
The chapter art is in fact correct.
In fact correct, per the canon. There we go. When in doubt, count the books, not the movies.
Yes.
Sound good? Sound good.
Sounds good.
Okay, so the other kind of interesting thing about this particular chapter as like an overarching theme is something always happens on Halloween.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
You know, which is kind of interesting just because it's like we know about the Defense Against the Dark Arts position being cursed and like no teacher is able to like last for more than a year.
Yeah.
But it's also like, you know, last year in year one, this is like when Quirrell lets the troll in, and year two, you know, it's the Death Day party, but it's also the first attack by within the Chamber of Secrets.
Right.
In Prisoner of Azkaban, technically what's actually happening is Sirius Black is breaking into the castle.
Right. So it's like, that's not, I guess, I don't know. It's like, it's perceived in the moment as a bad thing that happened.
Right.
Because
right.
Everyone considers him a convicted, you know, murderer, and he is breaking into the castle to murder someone. It's just not who you think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's for much more understandable reasons.
Yeah, right. Also, yes. Also true. Yes, yes, indeed. But there's some curiosity in my mind as to like whether or not Halloween itself was also cursed. Like in some weird way, like where when Voldemort's backfiring Avada Kedavra.
Right, because it's the same night that Harry is attacked as a baby is on Halloween.
Yes.
However, yes. That end, Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington was also murdered or was also beheaded on Halloween.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's like maybe it's more to do with like the Gryffindor Slytherin split than with Voldemort specifically.
Oh. That's kind of fascinating because right. He is the ghost of Gryffindor.
Because he is the ghost of Gryffindor.
And then the night... Okay, let's think this through for a second because that's interesting. So then the night of Voldemort's attack, you would have Slytherin attacking Gryffindors. So that is an easy one to solve.
Yeah.
Lily and James both being Gryffindors.
Right, yes.
And Tom Riddle being a Slytherin.
Yes.
And then I guess technically in year one, you would have the troll attacking Harry, Ron, and Hermione, who are Gryffindors, on behalf... I mean, it's Quirrell, who's a Ravenclaw.
Yeah. I mean, Voldemort is on the back of his head at that point.
Yes, so, and influencing him.
Yes. So yes. That would count as Slytherin.
I think that would count as Slytherin.
He attacks the castle in some way.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Chamber, pretty abrupt Slytherin attack.
Yes, it's overt.
Literally on the wall.
Right, yes. But at the hands even of a Gryffindor in the way of Ginny.
Yeah.
Like, who's writing on the wall, I guess. Yeah.
And then you have, I suppose, Prisoner gets a little trickier because you would have like a Gryffindor attacking a Gryffindor, but a Gryffindor who has betrayed themselves to Voldemort.
Also true. Yes. Yeah. In a way that was so specific that you had a group of Gryffindors who were all friends and the one who betrayed was betraying on behalf of a Slytherin. So there's a little bit of that.
You could count that, I suppose. Then Goblet of Fire, you have Barty Crouch Jr. putting Harry's name in the goblet.
Do we know Barty Crouch Jr.'s house It must be Slytherin.
It must be Slytherin.
Yeah. Okay.
Makes you wonder what Barty Crouch Sr.'s house was.
That is also very interesting.
Yeah, I guess we don't know. I'm assuming it's Slytherin.
Yeah.
But okay. So that happened because his name comes out of the goblet on Halloween.
Right, right.
Right. And then what happens in Order?
I know. I was trying to think of Order.
Like, what happens? Something.
Surely something happens.
Something, but this must be really obvious. We were like, guys, come on.
I know. Yeah. The big one.
I know. Mr. Weasley gets attacked at Christmas.
I know, but anyway, so
something with Umbridge. I don't know.
This feels like a really fun thing to count to me as part of the lore. Like maybe the divide, because what we've always said when we go back to the Founders saga in our head is that like what you're going to watch is like the most contagious and fun and like exciting friendship between Salazar and Godric.
Yeah,
to the point where it's like everybody wants
that friendship.
Like yeah. it has to be the best. In every way,
right?
So that when it fractures, it's utterly heartbreaking.
It's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. But I like the idea that it would happen on Halloween,
yeah.
And then every Halloween, there's like a notable event that happens that demonstrates a fracture between the houses.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That is exactly. I think so. I could see that being like a thing where it's like it's just the Hogwarts has been cursed this whole time.
Yeah,
Halloween or something always happens. I don't know.
Right, right. Yeah. No, that's so.
Or maybe it wouldn't happen every time, but it's like when Voldemort's there, then it's more like Slytherin himself is in the castle kind of things.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you can't discount the fact that as the actual heir of Slytherin,
yeah.
which even that, I mean, could easily play. Into it because we're not ever told anything about Salazar's own family.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of interesting because he must have had at least like offspring of one kind.
He must have had offspring of some kind. Yes.
The curiosity would be like what happened there or why or whatever.
Right. And I guess you're supposed to think they eventually marry into the Gaunts.
Eventually.
At some point down the line. And somewhere in there is the Cadmus Peverell line gets mixed in with the Slytherin line.
Arguably before or
yeah, after. We don't know whether it's before or after. I've tried to look that up so many times and people are like, yeah, it's hard to say. Everyone tries to cite the date on the grave in the movie for the Peverells and it's like, that's not necessarily canon.
Yeah, that's like, you know, that puts too much power to like the prop designer, which well done on the prop. But
yeah.
But it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, we can't let that be the dictating force behind, you know, what we consider it like to be.
But we also don't know when Hogwarts was founded.
But that's okay. So this is the other. I know we're way off the rails, and I'm so sorry about that. But I feel like the thing that I would love about the Peverells predating the Founders is that it provides opportunity for even the Founders to be dealing with powerful magical artifacts.
Right.
But like for the most part, you think of the Founders as kind of being like the dawn, if you will, of like wizard kind.
Right.
But in reality, they're just the ones who form like the first official like communities, I feel like, within the wizarding world.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that there can't be cool, powerful dark.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they make powerful objects themselves.
They do indeed.
You know, they each have their own. It's like, it's kind of interesting in that way. It's like you have like Voldemort, that's the collection Voldemort's going for. He's not looking for like the Deathly Hallows. He's looking for like the Hogwarts Hallows or something.
The Hogwarts Hallows.
Right. Yeah.
Oh man. Halloween.
Oh my gosh. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I guess that makes sense. Cause it's like Death's Day or whatever.
Death's Day. Yeah. That does make sense.
But Hallow means like holy object or something.
Yeah. So there's something to that.
There is. That's, you're right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's
okay. There's something there.
Anyway.
Well, we haven't even gotten one sentence into this.
I know. Well, I mean, we had to sidetrack, but anyway.
Well, of course we always do. The first paragraph I love. It is so good. It is talking about how like October arrives and spreads a damp chill over the grounds and everyone gets a cold. And, you know, it's like as an example of how that was affecting people, Ginny Weasley, who'd been looking pale, was bullied into taking some by Percy. Like, what a great sentence all around. Because one, it is actually telling you that Ginny is pale, which you're supposed to assume is because of the cold weather, which it's not. It's because she's opening the chamber.
Yes.
And then in the same sentence, she is bullied by Percy into taking some potion. So it's like in one sentence, not only are you told who the culprit is, but you are dissuaded away from that person and meant to look at Percy, who I guess is supposed to be the red herring, as like this jerk brother.
I know. This could be its own video essay, is the failure of the creation of Percy as the red herring in this book.
Yeah.
It's just like it's there, and it's there consistently. It's just I can't take Percy seriously enough to think
know.
It was him.
I just like, I know. People told me they thought it was Percy. I was like, I don't, like, I believe you, and I, you know, as I read it, it's like, yeah, there's lots of stuff throwing shade at him, but it's just like, it doesn't feel like throwing shade. It just feels like it's in character.
It's just in character. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. So then we, you know, we scroll down, we get like, this is one of those chapters that I think is also jam packed with like lots of, like little factoids that can totally trip us up during like Jay versus Ben episodes.
Oh, this was a trip. There were so many things I circled that was like, that's trivia. That's trivia. That's trivia.
Right, right. Like, this is like one of those where it's like how large are, what were Hagrid's pumpkins compared to in the Death Day party in Chamber of Secrets? And it's like, okay, how big could a pumpkin conceivably be? Let me look at like a Volkswagen Beetle or something. You know, like what are we talking here?
I just read this and I don't even know what it is.
You don't even remember?
No.
It's garden sheds.
Garden sheds. Garden, I remember it sheds. Said three people could sit inside of
they
one.
They could indeed, just like they could in a garden shed.
I feel like more, I could fit more than three people in a garden shed.
What kind of garden shed do you have?
I don't know. I'm thinking about like the shed next to Mama Scott's house. our childhood neighbor.
Our childhood neighbor / babysitter.
You know, like the shed you like see sitting in the parking lot at Lowe's. We're like, we'll just deliver this to your house.
Dude, I actually covet one of those sheds. I need a place to store my lawnmower. But anyway, not the point. But yeah, so this is one of those where
it's like a small house.
It is like a small house.
Yeah.
Yeah. A she shed.
Yeah. A she shed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For you and your two best friends.
What I'm saying, but more, you can fit more than two.
Right, yeah, I got right, you, I got you, yeah. But then we scroll down a little bit, and this is like one of those things that I think really lit the fire underneath us under the theory that Filch is in fact a poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably, like, this chapter, I was like, this is the chapter that really breaks our Filch is the poltergeist theory.
No, it does not.
It doesn't at all. I thought it did.
It helps
I was like, I thought for sure, and I want to get to it, I won't spoil it right now, but basically what happens is Harry has been having to deal with this cold, rainy weather in a way that is slightly unique because Oliver Wood is still like all about his training sessions for Quidditch.
I highlighted that Oliver Wood's enthusiasm for regular training sessions, however, was not dampened. I just said never. Oliver Wood's like tunnel vision for Quidditch is amazing. I never realized how present it was.
Yes, yeah. No,
like he cares about nothing else. Also, before you get to whatever you're going to say, I also love that it, like two sentences later, it says, Fred and George, who'd been spying on the Slytherin team. It's just like, oh, like Oliver's so concerned about spies because he does it.
Oh, yeah. This is like the classic, what is it, like deflecting or whatever, where it's like, you know, if you're engaging in some kind of like specific behavior where you're being like sneaky about something, then you think everybody else is being sneaky, and it's like, no, you're just like reflecting your own behaviors back onto other people. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly why that's why Wood's paranoid, is because it's exactly the kind of thing Wood would do. Which is hilarious. But so what I was going to say is that so the from all these extra Quidditch training sessions, Harry keeps entering the castle splattered with mud, which is it's always kind of like one of those funny things for a couple of reasons. The first is that like Quidditch is a sport played in the air. So it doesn't feel like there should be that much.
There should be that much mud.
They might be extremely wet, and I suppose you have to walk from somewhere. Although this is even one of those where I'm in my head, I'm like, oh, well, they probably land in the middle of the pitch and then have to walk over to the locker rooms to change. And I'm like why would they land in the middle of the pitch instead of just like landing on like the little like walkway to the locker room?
Yeah, like fly as it's like Harry's muddy from practice. From the walk to the castle?
Right.
Not from practice, actually.
Actually, practice had no mud whatsoever, but also, we're super muddy because we have to walk across the property to get there.
Right. Even though we could fly to the front door.
You could fly to the front door, yes. So the thing that's always stood out to us about this particular thing, and I may be jumping ahead a little bit, though, is just that it makes Filch so upset because he has to clean up the mud that apparently Harry, who has now entered the castle by himself, where's the rest of the team?
Where is the rest of the team?
You know, it's like he's like about to get like detention for walking around being muddy, doing a like school sanctioned sport that at least six other people and possibly two Slytherin spies should also be returning from.
Exactly. I know. No mention of the Slytherin spies who were clearly out there watching the Gryffindors.
Almost certainly. Yeah. Almost certainly. Yeah. So, but anyway, the point is that like Filch is like, oh my God, it's going to take me forever to clean up. And it's like, why is it going to take you so long?
It should not take you that long, dude. Like, yes. I think like, especially because it's like, he says it's like an extra hour of scrubbing for me. And it's like in what is Order of the Phoenix, Fred and George unleash their portable swamp into one of the corridors.
Yes.
And it's like Umbridge can't figure out how to get rid of it. But like when, you know, she finally leaves Flitwick, I think it says Flitwick like gets rid of it with like a wave of his wand.
Yes.
Like he does it like instantly.
Yes.
And it's like Filch's whole job, like part of Filch's whole job is keeping the castle clean. And it's like, he should be one of the best people at magic. I know we can't do magic, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, right.
But it's like, the point is that cleaning up enormous swamp-sized messes for wizards is as easy as waving your wand once.
Yes.
Especially like, maybe not every single wizard would know how to do that, but if your job is keeping the castle clean, then you should be able to do that. Like, the person whose job it is to clean the castle in a magical place should be someone who can do magical cleaning spells well.
You'd expect them to be adept,
yes,
in this particular field.
Right.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, in a completely non-magical world, it does seem like the task of keeping a castle clean,
yeah,
sounds like an oxymoron.
It does.
Like, it's,
yeah,
like, I can't imagine trying to keep an entire structure built of stone clean.
Especially by yourself. Like, not only, he's like the caretaker, so it's like, he's supposed to, is he in charge? Is he like the custodian and the security guard?
Oh, but don't forget, Jay, there are also house elves.
Oh, that's right. There are house elves at the castle. Like, why is Filch doing, why is it his job to clean it?
I have no idea.
House elves clean the Gryffindor common room every night.
And it seems like house elves are exceptional in this,
yes,
regard. Yeah.
And they like it.
Right.
And can do it magically.
Right, right. Oh, no, I know. None of it makes sense.
Not that they should have to.
No, of course, right.
No, yeah, but like, yeah, but that is how it is in here. And like, why is Filch doing anything? Nothing about Filch makes sense. The only thing that makes sense is that he is a poltergeist and like this is his lot in life.
Yes, which I feel like is just going to be like reinforced multiple times as the chapter unfolds. But anyway, yes. So important details to keep an eye on. Harry tracks Mud into the castle.
Yeah.
From there, he runs into Nearly Headless Nick,
yes,
who I believe is kind of like staring emotionally out the window at, mm-hmm, the rain or something. There's particularly, I feel like, a couple of, like there's a line here that basically says that Harry was able to look through Nick at the window, like at the rain that was coming on, like coming down outside. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's just like a tiny little ounce of setup for the scenario that you can see through ghosts into,
yes,
something else. So when Justin Finch Fletchley has his basilisk attack, this is sort of like the like, ah, yes, because you can see through ghosts enough to where you could also,
yeah,
like have your vision sort of like just mildly impaired enough to only be petrified instead of killed.
Right.
Yeah. So there's that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say there is down at the bottom. It says, or you learn how Nick was executed, that he got hit 45 times in the neck with a blunt axe. Which is just sounds terrible. But the question we always have about this particular line is, did this particular event happen at Hogwarts? Because like the ghost is at Hogwarts. So you kind of think it would, like, would, if it happened somewhere else, would you then just migrate to Hogwarts because you were a Gryffindor?
I know. Yeah. This is the strange one because it's kind of like as the house ghosts themselves, like it seems like there are other ghosts that do reside in the castle, but the specific ones that are attached to each of the respective houses seem like they have like a higher position of notoriety.
Yeah.
Like he, like, is
the house ghost.
He's the house ghost. So, but then the big thing that I think you were possibly alluding to is that when we do enter the room of hidden objects,
yeah,
in
Half-Blood Prince,
where Harry hides the book, the Half-Blood Prince's book, you can see, like, leaning against the wall, there's like a specific line that says that there's like a bloodied axe.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, why would a school ever have a bloodied axe?
Ah, but yet we know that there was someone in the school who was failed to be beheaded by an axe.
By an axe.
So so it does seem like maybe it happened at the school. I guess we know that the Grey Lady and the Bloody Baron didn't die at the school and they're still back there.
They didn't die at the school, but they are both very significantly tied,
yeah,
to the school.
Like the Grey Lady is is a Ravenclaw.
Is a Ravenclaw.
Is a Ravenclaw.
Like a direct descendant.
Yeah, and then the Bloody Baron, of course, is just like in love with her, so maybe he follows her there. And also, his death is as a result of a mission on behalf of the school.
Also true.
Yes,
also
so true. You can see maybe why he would return there. Otherwise, it seems like I looked up if there was any circumstances under which we knew like what the circumstances around his death were. Basically, it was in 1492, which is confirmed later in the chapter, and we know that it happened on Halloween. And he was there. I guess there used to be like on like one of the official Harry Potter websites, you could see like when he goes to make his speech and gets interrupted later, you can read the limerick he actually was trying to say.
It's a, kind of like a little song, right?
It's like a little
like
song.
Like a Sorting Hat song almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it says, "Alas for the eve when I met Lady Grieve, a strolling in the park in the dusk. She was of the belief I could straighten her teeth. Next moment, she'd sprouted a tusk." So it sounds like basically he finds a woman and says he can straighten her teeth and then accidentally gives her tusks.
Yes.
And outs himself as a wizard and is then sentenced to death.
Sentenced to death, yeah, yeah.
But then it makes you wonder, like, if it happens at Hogwarts, certainly they've already known about wizards. You know, like it's a wizarding place.
That is also, that's a really good point as well. Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that I never really considered this that much, but like his name is Sir Nicholas, which means he was knighted at some point.
Sure.
Right? Which is I thought was kind of cool. When he must have been knighted then by King Henry VII, because he was the King of England at the time.
We looked up this little factoid, but I find it to be kind of strange because I'm pretty sure King Henry VII is followed by King Henry VIII, who is notable for specifically his beheadings of his wives.
Right.
And so it's kind of interesting like to choose the 500-year mark for a couple of reasons, in fact, because I think this is the first time throughout the series that we're ever given the date at which the story is taking place.
Oh, yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about like the Nimbus 2000, the Nimbus 2001, and the fact that these books would have been released in, you know, 1997, 1998 range.
Right.
So you could easily imagine a world where somebody would be using a naming convention attached to the year that everything was taking place within. However, once we discover that he was killed, killed 500 years prior, it's like, okay, now the story is taking place in 1992. Now,
right.
Now that is a confirmed fact that has been like added to the overall canon.
Right.
So really, this is the first time that the naming convention for the Nimbuses has been proven to
it doesn't make sense. Yeah. So I suppose as you're reading Sorcerer's Stone, it just was the Nimbus 2000, and you'd have been like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, 2000, the year, it's coming up.
Right.
That's probably when the story's taking place. But no, Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington's 500 death day party confirms the year as 1992.
But the other odd thing about to me, is just simply the selection of the year 1492 for him to have been killed during. Just because 1492 is quite a notable year.
Right.
Like if you're going to select any one year from the century that is the 1400s, it's probably the one most people would pull off the top of their head.
Right, yeah.
You like know, because it happens to be the year that Christopher Columbus like set sail or discovered the Americas in a
right.
sense. Yeah. So it's like, is there supposed to be like a nod to that somehow? That would be Spain that sent
right.
Christopher Columbus, which seems like, you know, no connections whatsoever. So anyway, I mean, it's just kind of one of those things where I'm like, why this year in particular? Like clearly it had to be a choice for some reason.
I mean, it could have just been like 500 sounds like a fun round number to be celebrating the death day party for. And if you're writing the book, you know what year it's supposed to be taking place in.
That's also
true. So you just have to just math it out, and then it's just, it just happens to be that.
Right. And I suppose the other detail that would be somewhat relevant here is that we're about to discover that the Chamber of Secrets is being opened for the first time in 50 years.
Yeah.
So it's also kind of like we've got like a 500 years ago, then like a 50 years ago.
That's true.
So 1942. Oh, that's it. 1942, 1492. It's the same numbers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Because that would be when the Chamber of Secrets was opened.
Yeah.
1942 versus 1492.
Yeah.
That's
interesting.
I bet that's like the little puzzle pieces sliding into place. I never noticed that before, though.
That is cool. Yeah, it is all the same numbers.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is another piece of trivia that I know I have gotten wrong before, though, because what we discover is that what Nick is lamenting is that he is not being permitted to join the Headless Hunt, which makes him rather sad. And he receives this letter from Sir Patrick Delaney Podmore, and that is like one of those questions where it's like, who rejects his request to join it? And I can never remember Sir Patrick Delaney Podmore. Mm-hmm. You gotta wonder whether or not these two knew each other in life, because they're both sirs, which means they're both knighted.
That's true.
So it's like, is there a chance that this is like some kind of like rivalry, or was it Lady Grieve from the song?
Lady Grieve, yeah.
Lady Grieve. So like, I wonder if like maybe Sir Patrick Delaney Podmore was a suitor.
And,
as was Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington.
Right, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were caught together and trying to win her affections. And he was like, well, I'll straighten your teeth. And she's like, oh my God!
Yeah, exactly. I mean, was that like an actual reenactment?
That was probably, how it probably went down.
I kind of feel like I was
witnessing. Did you think you were watching Bridgerton for a second?
I do, for one hot second, I sure did. I sure did. Yeah.
Man.
A little less heavy breathing, but I feel like I got it. Oh. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So we learned that Nick is rejected from the Headless Hunt by Sir Properly Decapitated Podmore, which I just love that title. He's like so petty about it.
Yes indeed.
And then we get introduced for the first time this book to Mrs. Norris as a reminder that she exists, because of course she's about to get petrified.
Yes. So this is like one of those things, because I think this chapter in particular does this a little bit, where it's like, let me tell you some things that you need to know that are going to be relevant as the story unfolds. Like, even as the Death Day Party, like as we get there, we get our first ever introduction to Moaning Myrtle.
Yep.
And that's one of those things where obviously we know that like Myrtle is going to be very important to the overall story. And I wonder if this was like a struggle where it was like, I need to find a way to have them meet Myrtle before being in the first floor girl's bathroom.
Right.
You know, and so it's like one of those things where it's like, I need an event that would bring ghosts into one place. This could be the thing, a Death Day Party. Because the other thing that always stands out to me is that like the Death Day Party, it makes so many massive assumptions, like with all like absolutely like disgusting kinds of food and stuff. Like it feels like the type of thing that would belong at a haunted house, but possibly disregards the fact that these were all just human people who would have like regular human appetites.
Right.
And I don't understand. Like I guess the idea they suggest is that like, the more disgustinger the food is, the closer they could potentially be to tasting it.
I know, but it still says like, can you taste it? And he says almost. So no.
It's like, so, but like,
so why?
Your palate wouldn't change. You wouldn't all of a sudden, like, I don't think in death all of a sudden you'd be like, ah, there's nothing more than I want than a giant bowl of larva.
Oh, I something. Know. Right. That part is so gross. And just seems like it doesn't make sense. Like you actually still can't taste it. So there seems like there's no point to go to the trouble. And also who set it up? Like they can't handle objects.
I know. Wonder the exact, so this is something where I was like, this feels like this to me feels like it's got Dumbledore written all over it, but it would be like Dumbledore, out of respect for ghost culture, would permit the house elves to prepare foods on behalf of the ghosts. Like that to me, that's what I would read it as.
Yeah. Like, I mean, something like that had to, they needed mortal help getting the party set up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. This can't be done without the aid.
I suppose the other function here is that not only does it introduce Harry, Ron, and Hermione to Myrtle ahead of time and us, the audience, to her, but it removes her from the scene of the crime with Mrs. Norris later.
Also true.
Because otherwise, maybe you just immediately ask her, but now you won't because she wasn't there.
Right.
But of course, if anyone had asked her in the last 50 years, we could have solved this. That's the other thing. Nobody asked Myrtle about her death.
I know.
In 50 years?
I can't tell if this is just supposed to be playing into like the trope that is like Myrtle's like feeling, like as someone who feels like they're being like overlooked, is the joke supposed to be like, yeah, Myrtle was so overlooked that even when we found her dead in a bathroom, nobody asked her what happened.
Right.
Like, it's like, surely they would. Surely.
I know. It's like, yeah. Even the staff?
Right, right. Someone must care. Like, what happened here?
Also, there's like a bit of a, like, I don't know. This is like a tricky, I feel like, problem for Myrtle and how the basilisk petrifies people, wherein if you see it through a reflection or through a mirror or through a camera or whatever, the basilisk will only petrify you. But like, it always seems to me like glasses should count as like a form of protection, because you're looking through something else. Justin Finch Fletchley sees the basilisk through Nearly Headless Nick, so through something else.
Yes.
And like, glasses are through something else.
It is technically a barrier. It's like, it would, like, be so interesting, because it would be like such an easy way to just to protect all the students. It's like, hey guys, everybody just wear shades.
Everyone just wear some shades. Like, you won't die then.
Right.
But it's
right,
like, yeah, clearly, like, it is, I mean, if it fixes you with its stare, it's supposed to kill you. So, I mean, clearly glasses don't work, because otherwise Harry would be so protected.
That's also true. You know? That's also true.
But, you know, I mean, I guess, I don't know if it's a difference between like a it's not just a reflection. I was going to try and make an excuse for the camera. Like, when you look through a camera, you're actually looking through mirrors. But like, there is like the ghost seeing through Nick seems the same.
If anything less, because yeah, he is not physical. He's not a physical wall,
right,
or object or anything. Like, he's like an ethereal mist.
Yeah. Well, the point is Myrtle wears glasses.
The other big question there is that it also possibly is the case that because we know that Tom Riddle creates the diary Horcrux with Myrtle's death.
Yes.
Which also means that the person creating the Horcrux does not need to be the one to actually perform the murder. Even if the basilisk is like an extension of him, or
acting on his orders is good enough.
Right, right.
To rip his soul.
Yes.
Because he orders the basilisk to do it, it is allowing his soul to rip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Must be the case. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's just interesting because it feels overall less intimate to me.
Yeah.
To have it be done that way versus like, you know, Avada Kedavra.
That exact trope carries forward to Deathly Hallows, where Snape is killed by Nagini. But even then, Nagini still has a piece of Voldemort inside of her.
Is the belief in that's true? Nagini's a Horcrux already. Is the argument at all because Snape believes? No, I'm sorry, because Voldemort believes that Snape is the master of the Elder Wand, that it would be foolish to use the Elder Wand to then attack Snape?
I think that is the reasoning. If you're wondering, like, why didn't he just Avada Kedavra him?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think that is the reasoning for why he doesn't do that and has Nagini do it instead. And it obviously, in his mind, counts as him killing someone else because the basilisk kills Myrtle.
That's the argument right there.
Right.
Yeah,
that works. But this Nagini would count even more so because she's a Horcrux.
But yeah, but it is the case, because, I mean, he's literally talking to Snape and he's like, this is really unfortunate that I have to do this because I need to be the master and you're currently the master, and so I need to be the one to kill you. So Nagini, step up, please.
Yeah, I know. It's like, you sure about that, bro? Because like,
it's like your logic feels. It almost feels like in an early draft of the story, there was a line written where this would have been spelled out that the person who is holding the Elder Wand can't attack the person who is the master of the Elder Wand out of fear of the Elder Wand backfiring, because it may have just been too much of an obvious spoiler that this is exactly what's going to happen when Harry faces him down.
Yes.
It's almost like I can't really take the time to explain it. Hopefully you'll just surmise it.
You'll just get it.
Yeah, time goes on. Anyway, we're like five books ahead here. So
no, but it's all still relevant to the situation.
It is. It absolutely is. I agree. So but I mean, it's very interesting, like what counts and what doesn't count and who's operating on behalf of what. But I suppose, to be fair as well, I mean, Tom Riddle is the heir of Slytherin, and the basilisk was left in the castle by Salazar Slytherin himself.
I mean, it is Slytherin's monster, but it doesn't like share a bloodline with him.
That's also true.
That we know of.
Whoa. Can you imagine? Mm.
But even if that was the case, it's not the same as just like, oh yeah, your dad killed someone, so you killed someone.
Yeah.
That's true. And this would be like your great, 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 great grandfather or something.
Right. Yeah. Probably add like 15 more greats.
As a giant snake.
As a giant snake. Yeah.
Hey there.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Anyway, as we move forward and we try to ask distinctions about things, the next thing that I think is kind of interesting is that we literally led this chapter, that first sentence that you were talking about with Madame Pomfrey, keeping everybody healthy from their colds, thanks to the pepper up potion. We then learned from Nick that, Filch has been in a bad mood because he's got the flu. And it's like one of those things where it's like, does the pepper up potion not work on poltergeists?
I know.
You know, because it seems like, this is like one of those questions where it's like, if he's a squib, then the question would be like, does magical healing not work on non-magical beings?
Seems like it still would.
That's the question.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. Yeah, I don't know.
Like, are they like different from like an anatomy standpoint?
Yeah, like can you not use magical cures on non-magical people?
I don't know. It's a good question. But either which way, I think it personally alludes to the fact that Filch is just not real.
No, he's poltergeist. The big one is on the next page here where Mrs. Norris like summons Filch to the situation where it says, drawn to the spot by the mysterious power that seemed to connect him with his foul cat. And it's like, first of all, that mysterious power is never explained, but in this chapter it is explained that Filch doesn't have any magical powers.
Yes.
So how can he not have magical powers and have a mysterious connection with this cat? Like, math ain't mathin', y'all.
Math ain't mathin'. No, I agree with you totally. I highlighted the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I was just like, how does this happen? Why does this happen? Why do we never learn?
I know.
Because it does seem like it's the case. Like, if Mrs. Norris is spotting something, then it seems like Filch is also somehow seeing it at the same time and is just always arriving on scene, lickety-split.
Because they're actually just one. They're like a shared being.
A shared being.
Of a poltergeist.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Split in two.
So when Mrs. Norris goes down, he's really losing a part of himself.
He's angry enough about it.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
You know even that tracks like Horcruxy kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, Harry's fighting a Horcrux, and this is like Filch just lost like a piece of his soul a little bit.
A little bit.
You know, yeah. To a piece of Voldemort's soul.
How about that?
There you go.
There you
Boom.
Go.
Okay. Nailed it.
Putting it all together.
There it is.
Okay, let's see here. So then we go down to Filch's office, which is kind of interesting because there's a
closet. His closet.
His closet. Yes, I'm sorry.
A dingy windowless room.
Lit by a single oil lamp dangling from a low ceiling. A faint smell of fried fish lingered about the place. Okay. So as a friendly reminder, when Dobby approaches Dumbledore about potential accommodations, I'm pretty sure Dumbledore offers him like 10 galleons a week or something like that.
I think so. And weekends off. Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't seem like the same Dumbledore who would be requiring Filch to work inside of a closet that smells like, you know,
fried fish.
Yeah, it's just like, what? Unless, of course, you know, when we go to the death day party, we know that they can kind of sort of almost potentially taste more disgusting food. So maybe the same thing is true for Filch.
Peeves is at the death day party.
He is at the death day party. Yeah, he's there. So, okay.
Although you know who's not is Filch.
It's Filch.
Yeah.
That's true. It seems classic Filch, though.
Reject.
Right.
I don't know if Filch is aware that he's a poltergeist because he is so like anti. Because if he's a poltergeist, it means he is the manifestation of rule following. And as we've talked about this before, but like the idea of magic is that it doesn't really follow the rules.
Right.
And so like that's why he can't do magic, because he is all about following rules, and magic is like the act of breaking the rules.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But so then also included inside of his office is going to be a highly polished collection of chains and manacles hung on the wall behind his desk, which just seems like, again, I'm like, I don't see a world where Dumbledore would ever allow those to
I
be
know.
Used.
It doesn't seem like those would be used. However, this also ties into the bloody axe thing. It's like, why is there a bloody axe? Why is there chains and manacles in this place? It's like, because it used to be a lot more brutal. They used to do executions here.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently or possibly.
Someone needs to ask Nick about how he died.
Okay, so here's the question. Yeah, because if they're beheading Nick, I'm going back to that. If they're beheading Nick, the question is whether or not the wizarding population is the one who feels like because at that point in time the statute of secrecy was not officially set in place yet. I don't think that happened until like the 1700s.
Right.
So that might just be the punishment on behalf of wizards being like, dude, we are trying to eke out an existence over here and you're trying to impress a muggle woman by fixing her teeth? Like, come on.
Dude.
You compromising our whole thing we're working on here at Hogwarts where we behead people.
It happens like the next day. He tries to fix her teeth on October 30th and the beheading happens on the 31st.
Wow.
I know. Like, they're like, no time for a trial. We get what you are, Tusk Man.
Tusk Man.
Yeah. Try and turn our women into elephants. Why don't you?
No way.
Nope.
Anyway, so let's see here. What do we got next? So then I think the other really important thing that we have happen is that Harry is about to possibly get like detention or says a suggested sentence.
A suggested sentence for, again, returning to the castle.
From a school of ancient sport.
Yeah, for doing his practice.
Yes, for doing his practice. However, there is an interference when there is a loud bang on the ceiling above the office, which made the oil lamp rattle. Peeves, Filch shouted, and basically is like, I'll have you this time, I'll have you. And then without a backward glance, basically Filch leaves the office and goes running upstairs with Mrs. Norris streaking along beside him because they are the same creation. This is kind of a fascinating one because of what we discover the noise is caused by. And while it is in fact Peeves, it is something that Nearly Headless Nick had done on behalf of Harry, who basically convinces Peeves to knock over the black and gold cabinet that also happens to be the vanishing cabinet. Mm-hmm. And not just any vanishing cabinet, but the same vanishing cabinet that Montague will eventually be stuffed inside of and lost for a period of days in
Order of the Phoenix.
In Order of the Phoenix. Yep. It is the same cabinet that then Draco realizes has a twin. Which is currently at Borgin and Burke's. The same one that Harry was hiding in this same book.
In the same book.
And that is then what Draco is able to mend and create the passageway between Borgin and Burke's and Hogwarts.
Right. So, big setup here. Also, I love how it's like Nick's idea to help Harry is to crash the cabinet. And like Harry eventually thinks him like, oh yeah, great job. That totally worked. But like it didn't really, I don't think.
How do you mean?
Like, I mean, he crashes the cabinet and Filch leaves to go inspect it. But then Harry's like, guess I should wait for Filch to come back.
Oh yeah, that's true. That's
and it's
true.
Like if Harry hadn't gone nosing around on Filch's desk, then it wouldn't have mattered.
Right.
You know, like if Filch had like put his folder away, then like he would have come back and been like, right, where were we? Oh, yeah, detention.
Right, right. You know? Sentencing, Jay.
Yeah, sentencing. Right, yeah, my bad.
Yes. It is really funny. But then in the meantime, while Harry doesn't leave the office, he happens to find the quick spell flyer. And this is something that I have no idea if I had like like rearranged this in my head or something. In my mind, for whatever reason, I had convinced myself that the quick spell course was something that was teaching Squibs how to be magical. And that's just incorrect. Like my own recollection of what the quick spell course was is wrong.
Yeah, I actually wrote down the same thing. It just said not really a Squib solution.
It's not a Squib solution at all. So like his having it, this is not like his identifying as a Squib. This is just him basically just being like, how can I learn how to do magic? Possibly, maybe.
Right.
And he's pretty ashamed of even owning this particular thing. But when it comes down to it, it just sounds like tutoring for wizards. It's kind of like, I mean, which kind of makes sense. Like there are certain things that I've done in my life, like my scuba training, for example.
It's
like, if I were to go scuba, like I haven't scuba dived in, you know, a long time, like 10 years.
Yeah.
And so I was like, if I were to go do it again, I would absolutely want a refresher before I go like deep underwater. So like the quick spell course literally sounds like maybe you're like in your like 30s, 40s, 50s. It's been a long time since you were in school. You need to touch up on some things.
Yeah.
Like it's like, I could totally see this just being a thing. So I had originally written down like, this is the part that really like kind of argues our point about like Filch being a poltergeist. And I was like, but then again, it doesn't really do that at all. Just tutoring.
Yeah. I mean, I think he later admits or self identifies as a Squib.
Okay. Okay.
Like he says he knows I might even be in the next chapter.
Okay. So that's still coming.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the line that I thought happened closer to the quick spell course.
Right.
But yeah, so I mean, that being said, this just goes back to the argument that Filch just doesn't know.
Like then it would just be the case that like he identifies as a Squib because he can't do magic, but exactly. He doesn't realize he's a poltergeist either because he can't do magic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's see. But it's also interesting to me that like, well, Harry's like, did this mean that Filch wasn't a proper wizard? And it's like, well, it does mean that, but it's like, we know that Filch can't do magic, and it's like, nobody's figured out that Filch can't do magic. like the students haven't picked up on the fact that he's scrubbing the floor when you definitely don't have to.
Right. I know. That's such a good point. It's like, this doesn't feel like it would be like a tightly kept secret.
Right.
You know, like for Harry to have discovered and then like tell to everybody else. It seems so much more likely that it would just be like well-known information.
Right. Like as long as you can outrun him, it's okay. Cause you know,
like what's he going to do?
What's he going to do? Yeah. Okay, pull out his wand. Right.
I don't think so.
Nope.
Anyway, so yeah, so then we go back out to Harry running back into Nick, and they kind of have their conversation about like, you know, I did that on your behalf, and Harry basically agrees to come to his death day party, which I did write like a little note there, like Harry's so kind, you know, like I mean, I think he's sort of like a little hesitant, and he's like, of course, you know.
Well, but
like,
not only does he agree to go, he doesn't even bring up the fact that Nick and his parents share a death day.
I know.
You know?
Yeah, I know.
He's not like, wow, it's my parents' death day, too.
How about that?
Yeah, I know.
I know.
He doesn't want to steal his thunder, you know?
Not one. Yeah. Not one
you know day. How I'm famous?
Yeah, happen to be on this exact day.
On this exact day.
Kind of a hard day for me.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So then basically Harry goes back to Ron and Hermione, where it kind of seems like Hermione's like, whoa, that's pretty neat. Like, we get to go to a death day party. I bet nobody alive has ever been to one.
I highlighted that because I was like, it doesn't seem like it'd be that weird that dead people would know living people.
No, it doesn't seem that strange at all. I mean, this kind of reminds me of like Coco, you know, and like the Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like in, I mean, that's like on a dedicated date.
Dedicated.
didn't even mean to. But the idea of people attending their loved one's death day parties doesn't seem like a bad thing.
It actually
seems kind of like a great thing.
Yeah.
Like I sort of like, so I wrote this down. Like Ron says like why would anyone want to celebrate the day they died? Sounds dead depressing to me. And I was like, I actually find the idea of a death day party to be kind of cool because it's almost like your birthday for the afterlife a little bit.
I mean, that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know that like, I sort of like it.
But
I also like Day of the Dead, like as a concept. I think it's like a neat way to like honor the people in your lives and tell those stories and you know, like kind of spiritually maybe spend time with those people.
Yeah, I remember when we were doing lots of research for the movie Coco before it came out, like learning about, God, I can never say the name of the holiday though, like
Dia de los Muertos.
Dia de los Muertos, yes, that. And like learning that like the like American funerals are like very different than other cultures where it's like a very solemn, forlorn, sorrowful, sad thing. There's grieving. And it's like, of course, someone dying is very sad.
Of course.
Yeah. But like in other cultures, it's more of like, it like they'll still be sad that the person has passed, but like their funeral is more like a celebration of their entire life.
Exactly. Which, yeah. which I feel like is catching on a little bit. Like I've heard the phrase like join us for a celebration of life, you know, yeah. Like that yeah. type of thing. Yeah. So yeah, anyway, but I mean, that's the thing. I mean, in sort of the overall theme of this book as like, or not even this book, the saga as a whole,
yeah.
is that like death is not something to necessarily not necessarily be feared, but yeah. like also you know, can be good in its own way, so to speak. It's the next great adventure.
Although Nick has never truly died, according to him.
That's also true.
Yeah.
That's also true because he chose that ghost life instead.
Yeah, maybe death day is not the right word.
I know. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You became a ghost day.
Yeah, ghost day.
Which mm-hmm. that seems a little more sad.
Yeah, yeah it does. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
being a ghost actually does seem like it's not the preferable option.
Right, yeah.
You know, because I think when Harry talks to him after Sirius's death, even I think Nick is sort of like, yeah, Sirius would never do this. He would never choose this path.
Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah. Doesn't seem like there'd be a lot of Gryffindor ghosts, though, you know? Like, there'd be a lot more like the people bravely accepting death.
You'd think. Yeah.
You know what's sort of a weird, here's a weird thought. Imagining, like, if, because in the wizarding world, like, ghosts exist, like, if, like, far enough, do they ever fade or anything? I wonder, like, will they, like, imagining some sort of like Armageddon event or like the heat death of the universe, like is Nicholas Domenzi Poppington still just sort of like floating around space, like I'm still here.
I will join that headless hunt one of these days. No, that's hilarious. That's a good question, but I think probably they would yeah. just be here forever.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I don't see why not.
Yeah.
I
don't either. Yeah, well, that's really a good reason not to be a ghost.
I know. Yeah, it seems like just like I mean that's honestly I always think this about villains. I'm like, everybody's always going for like immortality, and I'm like, immortality sounds exhausting.
Right, because here's what you don't want. It's a situation where everyone else is dead and you're not.
Exactly.
Right.
That seems
And it's
sad.
Like, you don't want to be more immortal than the earth itself, because right. you're going to have a real lonely existence for most of your life at that point.
Yes.
Even if you make it like another, you know, 20,000 years, if we're being real generous, you know, before all the people are gone, like, guess what? Then you're still going to be alive for a million billion years after that.
Maybe we should make a video about immortality where it discusses like the Voldemort basically surviving past all of humanity and just like sort of sitting on a rock being like, I wish I could get back into the cave, except the cave melted. Now I don't have a great way to get to the locket, and I really need to go destroy the locket. And oh man, now I'm just stuck.
Do you suspect at that point he would feel remorse?
Maybe so.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Some
yeah.
billion years into the future, like
it would take.
This
that
is
long.
Terrible.
I got to give it up.
I am. Wow. I made some mistakes. I don't. What am I a king of, you know?
Right. Lord of the Flies.
Lord, there's a real feather in my cap.
Okay, so moving on from that, though, we got, on a much lighter note, we got Fred and George Weasley trying to figure out what would happen if you fed a filibuster firework to a salamander, which I have to personally say I wouldn't recommend doing.
I know. I'm like, it works out, as we find out on the next page, but I highlighted that and was like, I mean, I have a guess.
It feels like what would happen normally to yeah. a firework, except at a salamander.
Except in a salamander.
Yeah.
It turns out they just sort of like whizzes around the world and breathes a little bit of fire and lands back in the fire, and it's okay.
And it's okay. Yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
The thing that I think is fascinating about this is that they must be taking care of magical creatures under Grubbly Plank.
Oh, I guess so.
Is that right? No. Or is it? Is it Grubbly Plank, or is it someone
no,
else?
No, yeah.
Because it's whoever decides to enjoy the remainder of their days with their remaining limbs.
Yes.
What is that character's name?
Oh, no. This is a good trivia.
That is a good trivia. That's a Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, Prisoner of Azkaban trivia.
Anyway, the point I was going to make, though, is I couldn't remember if there had been a reference to Care of Magical Creatures prior to this. We know that they are required to take to pick up a copy of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them as first years, but I couldn't remember whether or not Care of Magical Creatures had ever been referenced as like a course before. But they would be fourth years at this time.
Yes.
Fred and George.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
No. Or is it 1 year ahead of them?
What would it be? They're not seventh years when they leave.
When school. They leave.
Yeah, so maybe it's just 1 year ahead of them.
Okay.
Okay.
That means they make it onto the Quidditch team. No, but then they're on the Quidditch team as beaters, like, right away, as second years.
Oh, you're right.
Right? Would that be the case?
You are right.
Would there have even been tryouts then?
Huh.
Man.
What year? Yeah. This feels like information we should know.
It does feel like information we should know. People are like, what are you guys doing? You should know this.
Maybe they just leave before the end of their seventh year. Maybe that's just it.
Okay. Sure.
In Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
They get three OWLs each, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Good friend, George. My faves. Anyway, so as we move forward, there's a description of what the Golden Trio is missing out on in the version of the form of the Halloween feast, which includes just a variety of different things. I highlighted this because they are always details that I feel like, again, could be asked in trivia, but decorated with the usual live bats, Hagrid's vast pumpkins had been carved into lanterns large enough for three men to sit in, and there were rumors that Dumbledore had booked a troupe of dancing skeletons for entertainment. This is another one of those where I think in Goblet of Fire there is a rumor that Dumbledore had like purchased like 1,000 barrels of mead.
I know, it's like the rumors about Dumbledore's party planning are amazing.
I know, like Dumbledore must throw some absolute
some real bangers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I was like, we don't get confirmation about whether or not he did get the dancing skeletons. I was like, oh yeah, did you?
I know. I mean,
it seemed very non-Dumbledore to do that because that seems like, you know, raising the dead or something.
It does feel a little raising the dead-ish. It also feels like there is no suggestion that skeletons would dance of their own accord. So it seems mostly like you would just be able to bewitch the skeletons themselves to dance,
which I'm sure Dumbledore could do,
which he could definitely do. Yeah. But then the question is like, are they real skeletons?
Are they real skeletons? Because that seems disrespectful.
I know. Yeah, because we got like dance for me, skeleton,
dance dead body. Okay, also, I looked it up, and Fred and George are 2 years ahead of the gang.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that tracks, that
FYI.
Tracks.
FYI.
Pretty much what we thought the whole time.
Oh, this is another thing. We talked about this. We talked about the food earlier. When they're arriving at the Death Day party, it's this is how it is described. As Harry shivered and drew his robes tightly around him, he heard what sounded like 1,000 fingernails scraping against an enormous blackboard. And Ron's like, is that supposed to be music? And it's like, why would ghost music be different?
I know, that doesn't
make sense, especially because later in the chapter, Ben, when the Headless Hunt arrives, it is to the sound of a hunting horn, meaning they can make perfectly regular musical sounds. So why ghost music is this like eerie chalkboard scratching sound makes no sense to me.
It does seem extremely odd, especially because the ghosts otherwise like attend all the feasts and they seem to be like they seem to enjoy being there and like a part of the action and everything. So it's not like all of a sudden that like once you're a ghost, you're like, nothing like nails on a chalkboard.
I know. How are they getting the instruments either? You know, like, are they playing music?
Are they playing music, or is there a chance that every one of these players in the 30 what is it? The quavering sound of 30 musical saws played by an orchestra on a raised black drape platform. The question there is like, were all of these ghostly musicians playing music
as they died? Yeah, because like the Bloody Baron still has the chains on him.
Okay, I want to ask you about the chains because I think this is kind of an interesting one because we then get a line from Ron who says, "Careful not to walk through anyone," said Ron nervously, and they set off around the edge of the dance floor. They passed a group of gloomy nuns, a ragged man wearing chains, and the fat friar, a cheerful Hufflepuff ghost. And then it says like two lines later, Harry wasn't surprised to see that the Bloody Baron, a gaunt, staring Slytherin ghost covered in silver bloodstains, was being given a wide berth by the other ghosts. This, like, is the ragged man wearing chains? It feels like that's the Bloody Baron, does it not?
Right. The Bloody Baron has chains, right?
I think so.
Right. That's how I've always thought of it.
So it's kind of like, it must not be this. I mean, obviously, like, you know, hey, look, more than one ghost is allowed to have chains.
Yeah.
You know?
Obviously.
It's like just be your own unique self as a ghost.
Or right.
However it is you would die, because that's probably the condition you were left in. But yeah, I don't know. I always, that was kind of interesting to me. I was like, oh, the ragged man wearing chains, that was the Bloody Baron. And then I got like one sentence later, and I was like, no, the Bloody Baron is over there.
I did the same exact thing. I was like, oh, that must have been him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But obviously, there's just two ghosts wearing chains. Maybe that's the ghost of Christmas past.
Why not? Why not?
Just at the party, you know?
Yep. We'll take it. We'll take it.
And then we get Moaning Myrtle.
We talked about here. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit. And this is sort of like my theory here is that like this whole chapter is just sort of designed to be a way to get you like a little bit more acquainted with ghosts, but also to introduce Myrtle to the trio.
That's sort of my thinking there.
Then we get sort of like we get the whole food conversation, rotten fish laid on a handsome silver platter, cakes burned charcoal black.
Who made the food?
I don't really know.
Where do you just get maggoty haggis?
I don't know if there is anything more unpleasant sounding than maggoty haggis.
Pretty bad.
But it also sounds like it could be a nursery rhyme. Now, everybody, let's sing maggoty haggis.
Maggoty haggis. Ew.
Yeah. Maybe I'm going for like a Raggedy Ann type something.
Maggoty haggis, her best friend.
Yeah. Either which way, though, this is sort of the setup as the trio was able to then go and sort of exchange a little bit of time with the rest of the ghosts. But mostly, I think the big thing is that it has taken the trio away from where they would have been otherwise, so that when Harry starts hearing the voice, the rip, tear, kill, it makes them look really, really, really guilty when the rest of the Great Hall is released from the feast.
Right.
And they are now discovered right next to blood written words on the wall that says the Chamber of Secrets has been opened. Enemies of the air, beware. Which I went slightly haggard.
You kind of did there. Yeah.
I didn't mean to. So that's the other thing too, is that it's sort of like you can't really have Harry, Ron, and Hermione placed in a compromised position if they're just otherwise at the feast.
Yeah. The other thing, what I always think is kind of interesting about the basilisk is like his inner monologue. It's just a rip, tear, kill. So hungry for so long. And it's like, it sounds like he is just absolutely going to eviscerate somebody and like eat them. And it's like, he's got the giant fangs and he's like, it's not like you couldn't have eaten Mrs. Norris, you know?
That's true.
Like,
that's true.
What is he doing? Why isn't he eating the people?
I don't know.
Like, I'm so hungry. You're dead. Well, I'll see ya.
Well, I best be off now. Back to the pipes.
Back to ripping and tearing. Like, he doesn't rip or tear anyone.
No, not even at all. Not even at all.
No.
Very capable of such things.
I know.
But doesn't do it. The question I asked is, how is it alive? Because it says so hungry for so long. It's like, we're talking about a literal millennium that has gone on since the creation.
It's like, I think when they get down there, it says like it's eating, there's like a bunch of like dead rat bones and stuff. So it's like surviving on stuff like that.
Yeah, so what
what do you mean so hungry for so long?
You're eating plenty of rats.
I know. He's like, it's been 12 hours since this morning. It's so long.
I'm so bored.
Oh, man.
It does sound like a rather miserable existence.
It does.
So anyway, let's see here. We get like the description of Mrs. Norris, the like hanging from her tail from the torch bracket. Oh, go ahead.
Yes, we do. You're right. Harry, Ron, and Hermione are like found at the scene of the crime and are unable to escape it because of this sentence. It says, from either end of the corridor where they stood came the sound of hundreds of feet climbing the stairs and the loud, happy talk of well-fed people. Next moment, students were crashing into the passage from both ends. Like, why? Where could be the destination of all these students that they're arriving from both sides?
I know.
Like, everyone is like, oh, we meant to go right. And all the other people are like, well, we meant to go left. Like, are we all about to like just cross each other in the hallway? Why didn't you go the other way to start?
It feels like an awfully like field goal post shaped set of hallway systems where like everybody leaves the Great Hall either to the left and the right, and then you either like go forward and take a right and then or go forward and take a left, and then we'll convene at the, like whatever this corridor
the
is.
The bathroom. Is everyone heading for the bathroom right now?
Everybody's like, man, that feast.
Woo!
Too much fiber in the pumpkin juice.
I know. Gots to pee. Let's go. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my God. Is that Harry and a dead cat?
No, wait. And blood on the wall?
What? It was him for sure.
It's definitely, although that's, here's my other thing. This is my other big note. So it's a really bad position to be in for the trio, to be found essentially at the scene of the crime in a way that is like pretty darn gruesome. Not the least of which is again Mrs. Norris hanging in such a weird way and grim way. But then like you're watching all this happen, and I feel like a lot of people tend to think like, oh, it's probably Harry who did it. But then Draco comes out of like the crowd and goes, "Enemies of the air, beware. You'll be next, mudbloods." It was Draco Malfoy. He pushed the front of the crowd, his cold eyes alive, his usually bloodless face flushed as he grinned at the sight of the hanging immobile cat. It's like, dude, students of Hogwarts, worry about that kid.
I know.
Come on.
That second year, that 12-year-old who just pushed his way to the front of the whole school.
Right.
He's like, what boldness?
What extreme boldness?
I know.
It's like, I'm sorry, guys. But like, I have to permit enough grace to the students of Hogwarts to where everybody's looking at the situation. It's like, dang, Harry, Ron, and Hermione were here, but that kid seems sus.
There is, I think, a situation with who is the other Hufflepuff. Not Justin Finch-Flett. Maybe it is Justin. One of the Hufflepuffs is talking to them later, and he's like, that Draco Malfoy, he seems like a real problem. And they're like, it's not him. Shut up.
Jeez, Hufflepuff kid.
Come on. We already did that.
Have a more memorable name next time.
Ernie McMillan, I'm pretty sure that's who it is.
That's old DA lads.
The DA, exactly. I also like how when Draco amidst the other... just the seven other Gryffindor Quidditch players calls Hermione a mudblood. It causes such a kerfuffle as to like blows are exchanged, and now here he is, 12-year-old little brat, just shouting mudblood to the entire school, and everyone's like, "Yeah, all right." Not quite the same reaction, was it?
No, not. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you can't just go shouting racial slurs in front of an entire school. And feel like, oh, this will be fine.
Yeah,
like it's like no.
So people, but wait, Harry, it was probably him.
People are more decent than that.
You know how last year he fended off Voldemort? It was probably him.
Let's all point fingers. Yeah. Anyway, just a tough overall night. Bad positioning, as per always with Harry, who's just cursed with a little bit of bad luck there. But that does bring us to the end of the Death Day party. And I got to say, like I said, coming into the chapter, I didn't know that this was going to be something. I was kind of like, the Death Day. I knew we'd have to do it from the onset of this project. I actually had quite a bit of fun with it. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, there is that. Do you have a review for us?
Well, Ben, I sure do. This is from Hufflepuff Surprise!
Wow! I'm completely shocked.
I know. The title of their reviews is So Much Macho. Which is a joke from our What If series. What if James had kept the invisibility cloak?
Yes.
Hufflepuff Surprise says, I've listened since the beginning of the podcast. It took me ages to do it on my podcast app. If you don't know about the title, don't ask. Question, what would happen if Ron didn't immediately tell Harry not to tell anyone about the murmurs and Harry just told Dumbledore? Like, so if Ron wasn't like, it's not good to hear things, Harry, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So, I mean, this is always sort of like one of those things where I feel like I don't know at this point in the story if Dumbledore in access to Dumbledore seems much more limited. Like I don't even know if like Dumbledore is intentionally trying to not spend more time with Harry in particular to permit him that opportunity to have the childhood that he kind of was deprived of otherwise.
I suppose.
We know that Dumbledore specifically is withholding information on this exact basis on some level.
Right. But so this is like a threat that is like very like endangering the other students.
It is endangering the other students.
Like this is something Dumbledore should step in on.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like the stone where he's like, Quirrell can't get it no matter what. I'm not actually concerned.
Right. So I'm trying to think. Okay. So let's just imagine for a second that Harry is able to get to Dumbledore. He tells Dumbledore what's going on. Dumbledore is like, oh man, this happened like 50 years ago and that was a huge problem. Okay, so do you have a situation where together they discover the Chamber of Secrets and go down?
I have to say I still kind of doubt it because like the thing is, it is known to be Slytherin's monster, and Slytherin is already known to be a Parselmouth and known to be associated with snakes, and like the basilisk is known to be able to petrify people, and it's like there's petrified people and Slytherin's monster, and it's like that's all you really should need to be able to connect the dots to basilisk.
I know, especially when you consider the fact that like Dumbledore is otherwise apparently best friends with Newt Scamander who wrote the book.
And like Hagrid literally barges into Dumbledore's office with a dead rooster.
Yeah.
You know, which is like another known like symptom of the basilisk. And the, you know, like he shouldn't even know about Aragog, you know? Like, there's no reason Dumbledore shouldn't be able to figure out that it's a basilisk.
No, there's not. Because that's the thing. Like, the writing is literally on the walls.
Literally.
But, like, this is one of those where us, the reader, is being given information in such a limited capacity.
Yeah.
And we don't know all of the existing lore surrounding basilisks in particular, but as somebody who exists inside of this world and is otherwise one of the most clever wizards of all time, yeah, it does. It seems like he should be able to reverse engineer what the heck's going on pretty easily.
I mean, if you buy the book, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, like, basilisks are one of the beasts in the book.
Right.
You know, it's not like hidden from the book. Like, some of the creatures that you see in the story are not in there, surprisingly. But, like, the basilisk is in there, so I don't... And, like, Hermione figures it out, even though...
Okay, but let me back you up a little bit here. Because the other thing that I think is interesting... Let's just say Harry goes, talks to Dumbledore, they figure it out. All it takes is the cry of a rooster to kill the basilisk. So it could be the case that... Because here, this is what I think is interesting. It could be the case that Dumbledore's like, I know what to do. Let's just... Harry, where are you hearing it? Like, okay... We will track down the location. Let's assume they get in there. They can bring a rooster down there. Kills the basilisk.
Done. Yeah.
So Slytherin's monster taken care of. Attacks all clear. The problem is that Tom Riddle can probably still come back. The basilisk is playing no role.
Right. It's just sort of carrying out a different mission.
It is carrying out a different mission.
The Horcrux is still able to accomplish. It's like it has two goals.
Yes.
One is like come back. One is... purge the school, but like they're not really related. It's just sort of like a symptom of the diary being back.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So if you basically destroy the threat and nobody ever discovers that Ginny's been talking to Tom Riddle in the diary,
yeah,
then probably Ginny just goes down to the Chamber of Secrets herself and just has her life force drained and does in fact die, and Tom Riddle as his younger form comes back to life.
You know what? This could be another what if. Is like, what if Tom Riddle didn't tell everyone he took Ginny into the chamber? Like, why does he write it on the wall?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, if you just, like, what if she just sort of, like, disappeared that night and no one really noticed, and then the next morning, like, oh, I'm back.
She was in an unfindable room.
Right, like, yeah. Even if you noticed, what are you going to do?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's probably just your classic villain, like, monologuing. Like,
it is exactly what it is.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. It's like, the monologue is, it's so funny, like, the movie The Incredibles makes fun of, like, monologuing, because every single time I ever watch any superhero movie or any villain-based movie ever, I'm always like... And they're monologuing.
They can't not do it.
They need the credit for the brilliance of their plan so much that they have to explain it. They have to explain it to the hero.
Have you ever read the graphic novel Watchmen?
I've seen Watchmen, but I have not read Watchmen.
It is so there is a great scene at the end with the villain Ozymandias.
Yes.
And he's doing the whole monologue thing, and they're like, why are you telling us all this? We're gonna stop you. And he's like, I wouldn't tell you all of this if I hadn't already succeeded. And he like opens the screen and it's like, it's done.
Yeah.
Like, I did it like 10 minutes ago. Are you stupid?
Yeah. It's such an incredible way to turn the trope on its head. It's like I am monologuing because it is over.
Cause I already won. Like game.
Yes.
See ya.
Game, set, match.
Yeah.
Checkmate.
Yep.
Boom. Not me. Not Hermione.
Yo.
all right, so that finishes us off.
That does. That is gonna do it for us today here on Through the Gryffindor. But join us next week where there is some fantastic chapter artwork for the writing on the wall as we venture forth into chapter 9 here on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP SmartSide today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save